there were a great deal of emphasis based on the Sunday school, and our Sunday school, when we first started, had the highest percentage of children in the Sunday school as compared to members. That, of course, was because our membership was young. We had children. It isn't so anymore. But the quality of the Sunday school was something that we all felt was one of the most important things we could do.
I'd like to ask about the social action commitment. How was that? Was that a consciously stated thing, understood? Was it a spoken thing that was understood among the members, that was something that was going to be an important part of the temple?
I think it was part of the general philosophy of participation, not only participate within our own community, but in the general community. I think it was more as a result of the people who joined Temple Beth, rather than a conscious decision, we must be involved, we must have a good social action committee. We had a good social action committee because that was one of the things everybody was interested in doing.
Now, your Rabbi Hirsch obviously has been a leader in that, but this preceded him.
This preceded him, and it was because he had to fit into that picture when he was being hired, and he was selected because it was felt that he would be part of that. He would be part of that situation. He had already made certain commitments in that area, and that was a very important part of the decision to hire him, because he was interested in that sort of thing.
That's very interesting to me. I'd like to go into that in more depth at another time. I think that's one of the keys to understanding your congregation.
Yes, well, it's the membership itself, I think if you examine them, are individuals who have sometimes greater commitment to the general community than they do possibly to the local Jewish community. And that may be something that others may criticize us for justifiably, but generally they are very much involved in the nuclear freezer and Vietnam before that, and whatever else is prevalently important in terms of social action. The social action committee has developed and participated in, and of course the rabbi himself has gone off sometimes ahead of the congregation on this, and has never been restrained, and would not be restrained. No, that's part of our philosophy, that under no circumstances is he to have be restrained any more than we want to be restrained, and he was to have that privilege.
He has freedom of pulpit.
Complete freedom of pulpit, and we may not like it. Some people may not like it to the extent where they have to leave the congregation, and that's very few, but I'm sure it has occurred. But nevertheless, he has that freedom, and also we have the privilege of saying, how can you say those things? And if it's done politely, I'm not sure that we change them very quickly, but I'm sure we have some influence in that regard too.
What are the biggest changes that have occurred in Beth Om?
Well, it's grown so big that become like other temples. That's some of the inevitable occurrence when any religious organization has too much success in terms of its financial stability. In terms of financial stability, it's done really quite well. And this, I think the method we have used is quite unique too. Each individual sets his own level of giving. He's given certain goals, certain ideas, but he sets his own membership dues, and the amount he contributes to the building fund are all things that are done voluntarily. With a few exceptions, they've been much more generous than what would be demanded of them. There are few who don't come up to it is believed that they can afford. They're talked to separately, but there are very few of those. As a result, there was some concern that there would be some shortage this year. I was just reading the minutes of the last board meeting, and it looks as though the pledges are coming in very satisfactorily, and they will not be. They'll be able to manage very nicely.
One thing that struck me in the services that I've attended is that a lot of people wear kippahs and prayer shawls, which, having been raised in Temple Hirsch, was very surprising to me.
This is a interesting development that is not just unique to Temple Beth Am, but I think nearly all the Reform synagogues that I've been attending are becoming increasingly traditional. I just came back from Toronto, and there's been a struggle there, so much so the rabbi had to leave, and there was a need for greater traditional services. And the older individuals, including some of the members of my family, whom I came from a traditional family, were not comfortable with it, whereas here we are not at all uncomfortable with it, and we've accepted it to the point where each individual wants to accept it. If you want to wear a kippah, fine. If you want to wear a tallis, that's fine. Now that's a change, and I think you're well aware of it. There was a time when the rabbi wouldn't allow anybody to wear a kippah or a tallis. He now wears one himself and wears the tallis himself. So that not only we have changed, but he has changed, and I think the pressure on him has not come just from us, but from all the other synagogues and all the other temples in the United States. Feel as though this is one of the factors that we in the Reform movement have lost to some extent, when we left behind a lot of our traditions, and our traditions where they aren't necessarily part of our religious dogma, and that was the reason they left them behind. They are nevertheless a part of our emotional makeup, and it's important for us to continue in order for us to have strong emotional ties with our tradition. Is that a change unique to Temple Beth Am? No, it's occurred in Temple Beth Am much more readily and comfortably than I'm sure it's likely to occur in some other temples, but it's part of the movement, I think, not only I think it's true in many other religious faiths.
Yes. Okay, I'd like to shift the emphasis of the interview now to the Jewish Community Center. And I guess as a prelude to that, I should ask you what other citywide organizations you were involved in, if any, as early as the Jewish Community Center, and how did you get started in the Jewish Community Center movement in Seattle?
Oh, I you know, those things are all so long ago that I'm not sure that I can give you an answer. I was always involved with organizations. I guess I'm an organization person, and whether it's the Pediatric Society, where I was president, or the I was very active in the community psychiatric clinic, and I was president there for a while. I was on the head of the building committee and helped build the community psychiatric clinic down on East Lake. We had many meetings in this house to get that done. I can't remember all of them, but little school, I was active in little school, etc. I was always active in the Jewish Community Center, and I guess in the Jewish Community Center, my first recollection of it was after it was a year too old. I wasn't there at the beginning. I remember going to a meeting at the old press club. And the reason I was invited was it was for the children's program. Being a pediatrician, I was asked to serve on that particular committee, and that was the first involvement I had. I very quickly became interested in seeing something more done, and it wasn't long after that that we moved to the Elks Club, and I was on the board, and became increasingly active there, and. From the Elks Club, I was interested. We sold the Elks Club, and I can remember the great struggle when they, in order to sell the Elks Club, the board had to be convinced that the Elks Club wasn't going to be a good place for a community center. Its location was so ideal, we were very reluctant to give it up, but as a building, it was hopeless. One third of the space was for elevators and stairs going up and down, and the rest of it was eight or nine stories. You couldn't possibly have a staff to take care of it, and it took a long time for Al Schreiber to prepare his report and convince the community that this was not a feasible building. there was an offer to sell, and there were several offers, and I remember one came in, was all cash, and of course immediately that perked up my ears. Why does this individual want it? And it was for $180,000, and I said, nope, well, let's not take more than 220 or 230 or wherever it was. Anyways, there were some said, oh, let's take it while we can get it. And finally, we held out for 230, and of course, Seafirst needed it to round out their whole block that they needed for the Seafirst building, so that we got a little more than we would have otherwise. And then we moved to the building on 2nd Avenue, and it was a second floor space, which was a relatively large space, and actually we were able to do more there than we were in the other big building. But our programs essentially there were the children who used to be brought down. You used to see lots of children down there. I don't know whether you were old enough for that or not.
I don't remember.
And a Golden Age group, and other than that, we were devoting most of our time towards thinking about a new center. The tendency at that time in all the centers in the country were to put the centers out of the center of the city. The centers of the city, there was the Kauffman thing in New York, which had been encompassed, which was a very important center, one of the finest centers that we've had. The YMHA in Pittsburgh, and there were a few others that were right downtown. But the one in New York is a good example, because it became surrounded by the Jews left that area, and it became surrounded by, at that time, blacks and subsequently Puerto Ricans, and the Jews couldn't use the center to any great extent. So that the tendency then was for us to move out. Well, in order to get adequate space, that was another important thing, that we had to move out of the downtown area. We just couldn't afford to build anything or buy anything. Somebody had visions of building another Washington Athletic Club for the Jews down there, because we couldn't belong to the Washington Athletic Club or the College Club or the Rainier Club then. It became apparent that it was not feasible economically to do that. So we had to move out. So a study was done as to where the center of the population of the Jewish community was, and we did it by zip codes. And the center of population of the Jewish community at that time was in the center of Lake Washington, about 200 yards north of Mercer Island, between Mercer Island and what is now the Evergreen Bridge. Well, we didn't want to have to build on an island, so we had to look at the north end of Mercer Island or on the other side in the area where the Evergreen Point Bridge came in. Or a third point we looked at was at Madison Park, and we had properties at all those places
that
we looked at. That we looked at.
Okay.
We couldn't afford the one at Madison Park. It would have been a very good location. The one at Evergreen, again, didn't provide enough flexibility in building, and then the one at Mercer Island became available. It was a choice that has worked out well from my point of view. I think you have to put it in perspective. When we chose that place, we had assurances from the city transportation that not only would I-5 be completed, but also Empire Way was going to become a freeway. And
that was the R.H. Thompson.
The R.H. Thompson Freeway was going to be built, and there was going to be a good connection with the R.H. Thompson Freeway and I-90, which was going to be completed within a year and a half to 2 years from the time we bought our lot, all of which would have prevented the problems that presented themselves from the point of view of transportation and are still problems for us. So that was the site that was selected.
Right.
And I say it was a good choice. It was a good choice for several reasons. As a result of that choice, the population was moving towards the east. A lot of people moved into Mercer Island. At that time, there were very few Jewish families on Mercer Island. Now 10% of the population of Mercer Island.
But how much was that a self-fulfilling prophecy?
Oh, I think it was because it was there that they moved there. Well, I don't think there was any question about that. But the space was available for them to move there, whereas had we had it elsewhere, it might not have been as available, because it was a developing area. Herzl came out there. I have great regrets that we didn't build our offices for Federation out there. I have great regrets that we weren't able to build B'nai B'rith headquarters out there.
Talk about that. That was an idea that you and Norman Davis and some other people felt very strongly about, that a Jewish community center should house all of the city's Jewish organizations.
I don't think it was unique either to myself or to... there were many of us that felt that way.
Why did it not happen?
I think some of the professionals didn't feel as though they wanted to...
The professionals who worked for the organizations.
Who had worked for the organizations. And in order for something to be accomplished of that sort, you have to have an agreement on the part of the professionals and cooperation in order for it to develop. We had a plan. We had the JCC presented the Federation with a site, the costs, and all the rest of it. It could have worked out. Talmud Torah could have gone out there too. When I say the Talmud Torah, the Seattle Hebrew Day School also was thinking about buying an area out there and building there. And this was prior to the time they moved to
Forest Ridge.
To Forest
Would that
Ridge.
Have been contiguous with the Jewish community?
Yes. There was one, had they been able to buy one particular lot, it would have given us ample space. There's one particular lot there that's really given us a problem. But that could have been overcome. The Forest Ridge facility was an awfully good buy, and it didn't require as much in the way of immediate cash, so it became the one of choice. But I still am not sure that it is the wisest choice for our community. And it would, if you could just think of all those organizations being there, how much better off we'd all be. For instance, the Hebrew Day School needed athletic facilities. Well, they wouldn't have had to build any athletic facilities if they were there, because they were all there. They could have been used very easily during the day. There are many other advantages. They could have been one auditorium for both. It would have been cheaper for the community in the long run if they were all together. Even now, Federation, when we have a very large meeting, we go to JCC. I believe the decision that we finally reached, and those who were in favor of it agreed, that in order for it to function properly, we would have to have some small facility, a meeting room for board downtown, because that was the easiest place for all the people who were on the board to get to. But that wouldn't have been a great problem, because there are many places that can be leased at a very reasonable rate there. Does that answer all those questions?
Well, yes. I think what I'd like to do is just focus in on some of the issues that were involved. And one of the key ones, of course, and most controversial, was location, because people who lived far away from where it was eventually built had some reservations. I found a quote in one of the position papers that was put out at the time that I thought was very interesting. It says, "Seattle's atypical geography is one factor that makes this decentralization necessary." And that was probably about 65, 66. They were already planning for Mercer Island. But part of the plan was that there would be satellites. And the stationery has the satellites, has a map of Seattle, the Mercer Island site, and then it's got satellites. Tell me about that idea and the evolution of it.
Yes. That idea, by the way, again, was not for Seattle alone. Many community centers at that time were talking about satellites. We found it absolutely necessary to consider it, because we could not possibly serve the North End, the South End, Magnolia, in any other Queen Anne, in any other way than with satellites. So that was cranked into the budget. That was cranked into our thinking. The problem arose, however, well, number one, the Sephardic group in the South End did respond, and where there was a good Golden Age program down there. the youth did get into the center, so that they were moderately well served. The North End were not served at all, whereas there were many people in the North End who had been very active in the community center. They lost interest in the community center because they couldn't get there. It's still a 25-minute to 30-minute ride for us to get to the center through not comfortable traffic or driving. That may be improved now that I-90 will be completed, I hope, after all these years. So that attempts were made to start a program in the North End. There was one at Temple Beth Elm for the children. For some reason or other, no matter what, it may not have been financed well enough, but I think that wasn't the problem. There wasn't the interest. The people in the North End had their own peculiar problems. They are all individuals who have many interests, and they would send their children when it came to sending them to a nursery school. There were many nursery schools, and they weren't about to change that quickly. A good deal was invested in it. The first year they had an adequate number. I think they needed 24, and I think there were 18, and these figures may not be completely accurate. But then it dropped to 10 or 12, and when it got down to 8, they figured, well, you couldn't keep up with the school. So that the problems were such that whatever attempted a satellite wasn't successful. They couldn't pour too much money into it. When I say they, I mean JCC, because they were having their own financial difficulties with their one facility downtown. But this is going to be corrected. It took us 10 years longer than we thought it would, 15 years longer possibly. But as you know, the North End Jewish community is going to have a satellite program. How the nature of it, I don't know yet, but I have any doubt in my mind that there's going to be one within the next 2-3 years that's of sufficient magnitude so it will serve the community well and be a great benefit. I feel very strongly that it's most important for the general community to see one here, because it'll enrich the general community considerably. When I say enrich, I mean in many ways, not just financially. I mean enrich in terms of intellectual contributions that they can make. They have different interests that I think will be of real use to the community generally. So that it's going to be a good thing for the community. And as you know, and I think you're probably aware of the fact that we're having a real struggle right now convincing others, because they feel some other problems are more pressing. But I can't think of any problem that's more pressing than to encourage people to become part of the Jewish community and active in the Jewish community, and I think we're going to work that out somehow or other. Now, as far as the Magnolia and Queen Anne, no effort has ever been really made. The communities there have shrunk as compared to what they were, so that it hasn't been a pressing problem. But it's unfortunate that the people who do live over there have very little opportunity to really for their children to be part of the Jewish Community Center on Mercer Island.
Let me ask you about the planning on Mercer Island for facilities which had to take into consideration what they wanted to offer. How was it decided? I was looking through Al's papers, and there was a lot of debate about what they should build first. What was the key thing?
We started out with a program. We want a complete facility. Complete facility consisted of one, administration, meeting rooms for various programs, the children, the nursery, the young adults and the senior citizens, and an athletic facility consisting of a swimming pool and athletic facilities. And those are the three main divisions in a community center. Herman Sarkowski was head of the building fund and did a great job in getting things organized. When we started getting bids, he got the person he thought who could give us our best and cheapest bid, and that was Jack Benaroya. Herman was in the building business at the time, but he felt as though he would be somewhat of a conflict of interest, and he felt as though he ought to have somebody who wasn't on the committee, and that's why he asked Jack to bid, and there were several other bids. We had a hard time selecting the architect. And this time I was very active in the Jewish Community Center, and I felt as though there's only one thing you could do in terms of a professional, if you get the very top professional in the community, nobody can argue about why didn't he give it to so-and-so or why didn't he give it to if everybody recognizes him as a top professional, that's it. And we felt we did select the top professional. What was his name?
Paul Theory.
And he was the one who did our planning for us. And as far as the builders are concerned, that was strictly financial and competitive and also quality. And I think where did we leave off now?
You were talking about choosing the architect.
Architect and the builders. And then we started getting the bids in. Well, at that time, I think we had $750,000, I think, pledged. The bids came in well over that. 1.35, I think. You know, the bids were 1.2. We still owed money on the land. So that whatever it was, we were still off the beam. So we had a difficult decision to make as to just what we were going to do. There was one group that felt as though it should be just built, let's build what we have in hand and that's it. Another group felt as though let's build the whole thing and we mortgage it and pay it off as we went along. And one group said let's build two parts out of the three. We can handle the mortgages with the pledges that were in hand, that we did have in hand, although we didn't have all the money, and we'd be able to manage. The group that wanted to just build one section felt as though the section that they should build should be the athletic wing. Well, I personally was very much opposed to that, because an athletic wing, we are not an athletic organization. Unless we had something more than that to offer, we might as well stay home. And I couldn't see doing that. So that we had a real problem, and Leo suggested that we have...
Leo Oaken.
We have come out from New York, the head of JWB, and who was also head of Jewish Community Centers, and I can't remember his name.
I'm sure it's in our paper.
Yes, and he came out, and he talked about how important it was to have more than that. It isn't. He convinced, I would say, maybe 40% of the board. And I think had we taken a vote at that particular time, it still would have been, all we would have had was an athletic wing. Until Morris Pollack got up. And I'll always bless him and thank him, and I can never say enough good about Morris Pollack. And he got up and very vigorously said, what kind of community are we that we're going to be content with what is really third rate? We are a good community, we will work together, we will support it, and we have to do it. Well, it passed the board by not a great number, but a sufficient number. And that sort of vote, of course, you feel as though it has to be almost unanimous. The whole community has to be behind it, because we had to go out for money, for more money. And fortunately, it was passed, and that's what was done, knowing at the time that in the future we would have to build another wing. Mm-hmm. And I think
now that sounds like it was something of a turning point to make that decision, and to have to be in that position of raising that much more funds. So you told me in our pre-interview that you thought that the fundraising for Jewish Community Center was a turning point in this community's history.
Well, that's,
would you elaborate on that?
Sure. At that time, as I say, there were $750,000 pledged. We then have to, it was less than that, it was $450,000. And the next stage went to $750,000. The next stage, we knew that still wasn't enough. So we'd start another drive, and Mike Litvak, I couldn't remember his name last time, Mike Litvak, who was head of Bonds of Israel, he stepped in and helped us on our fundraising, and he was really very, very helpful. And Mike would tell you, now go and see so-and-so, and he will tell you so-and-so, and then you say, no, I need this and this, and he will say this and this, and we'd go back, and I would feel like a puppet, because this is exactly the conversation. But in any case, we finally got to the point where I think we raised $1.2 million, and I'm not too sure of the figures again. And that was the most that had been raised by far in the community, and there isn't any doubt in my mind that as a result of that increased level of giving, subsequent giving was much was improved within the general community. And the same thing, I think, is happening now with the very large amount of money that's being demanded for, was demanded for the community center this time.
Did that precede, that fundraising, precede the Six-Day War, which was in June, wasn't it?
67.
Yeah, June of 67.